movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to Committee Watch and Comment for Tuesday, April 8th. I'm Dave Raven. It's really great to be with you. We have a wonderful guest for you for our show today and on with the show. We have a really big, for you, those of you old enough to remember, we have a really big shoe for you, as Ed Sullivan used to say. It goes without saying that Trump has unleashed a fire hose of initiatives since returning to power on January 20th, including a Musk chainsaw to the federal bureaucracy, mass layoffs, attacks on judges and or ignoring their rulings, draconian arrests and deportations of immigrants, long-term damage to medical research, legal actions against the media and oppositional law firms, upending 80-year-old international norms, increased support for the murderous Israeli government, withdrawal of support for Ukraine, not to mention the upending of financial markets with his tariff. Well, it's a tax gambit. I mean, I don't even want to look at my 401ks. I refuse to look. It wouldn't be helpful. But what's largely missing from our understanding of this deluge is that Trump is operating out of a playbook created and implemented by Hungary's strongman Viktor Orban. And joining us to talk about this playbook is Canadian journalist Anja Nikiforuk. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, David.
I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Do I have it right?
Yes, you do. Nikiforuk, yeah. It's a Ukrainian name.
Oh, good. Ukrainian. Well, you and I have Ukrainian roots. Both my grandmothers were Ukrainian, so we can talk about that down the road. This is Community Watch and Comment. We want your comments. Please call in. We're going to talk with Andrew for a bit, and then we really want to hear from you. It's 202-588-0893. I will get to your calls. We'd really like to hear from you. 202-588-0893. Andrew, before we get to the heart of our discussion, you're Canadian. You're sitting at the top of a mound above your home in Alberta, and Canada is a big enemy of the United States, as you well know. And I just, what do you think about what's going on here in the lower 48, if you will?
Well, I think Canadians at first were really shocked at, we don't see ourselves as enemies of the United States, but Donald Trump somehow sees us as a nasty neighbor that should be annexed. He's threatened to annex us. He's has already imposed a number of tariffs, and his rhetoric and his actions have really shocked Canadians. And we're now kind of in the angry phase, and we're kind of trying to figure out, okay, what do we do next? How do we protect Canada? How do we change Canada so that we're not so reliant on the United States. So a revolution in Canada in terms of Canadians rethinking who they are, who they really primarily want to do business with, who they can depend on, and what kind of international links we're going to have in the future. So Canada at this point in time is just as unsettled as I think much of the United States. And I don't think people really, I mean, the bottom line here is that you you've got to use the right vocabulary, I think, to kind of describe what's going on. And Donald Trump's is basically directing what, I mean, many people would call the second American Revolution. And revolutions are by their nature chaotic affairs. They turn everything upside down. And that's what's happening in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. I mean, I don't think, given the rhetoric of the campaign of 2024, I don't think we quite expected what is unfolding now. I mean, you know, is Canada ready to be the 51st state of the United States? I mean, we, you know, it should be noted that, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but we have invaded your country before. I mean, I think there was an invasion in what, the War of 1812?
It was the War of 1812, yes.
Yeah, and we also, I mean, and that's what precipitated the British, you know, burning down Washington in that war in retaliation. I mean, apparently there have been unearthed war plans of an invasion of Canada. I mean, it's so ridiculous. I mean, this is our dear neighbors for hundreds of years. I mean, it's really kind of crazy.
Well, I mean, yes, it is crazy, but it's also revolutionary. And there's kind of a method to all of this. I mean, even the Trump administration calls it flooding the zone. So what does that mean when you flood the zone? Well, you do so many things, change so many things so rapidly that it's very difficult for anyone to focus on what is going on, let alone to marshal any protest against any one of these initiatives or changes or developments or whatever. And you can see this right across the board. I mean, he's downsizing the American government. He's changed his whole relationship with Europe. He's thrown America's weight and support behind Vladimir Putin in Russia, a man who's very clearly a ruthless, murderous dictator. So I think people have difficulty thinking about, what do we focus on? What's going on here? But that's actually, that's part of the game plan,
right,
is that you change things so quickly, so rapidly, that you keep people constantly off guard. And then you also create an enormous amount of fear and insecurity. And that's what's going on with this revolution. And I think it's also critical for Americans to remember, you know, that there are a number of other countries have already gone down this path. And one of them is Hungary. And Hungary, you would sort of think, well, wait a minute, that's kind of this remote nation in Central Europe. You know, why would we have to pay any attention to a country like Hungary? Well, in 2010, a guy by the name of Viktor Orban became was elected to power there. Again, very narrow margin, as is happening almost all around the world when populists are going up against the status quo. And then he set about a complete and total regime change over time. And he focused on changing the judiciary. He focused on changing the media. He focused on electoral reforms, with the end result that he changed the country. It's still a democracy, but it's not a fair democracy. I mean, elections are held, but the outcome is predetermined because of all of the ways Viktor Orban has changed the government and concentrated power into his hands. And so a lot of people call the Hungary today kind of a Fuhrer democracy, where you have this all-powerful leader who is controlling the government, who pretends that, you know, the country is still a democracy, when in fact it really isn't. The thing about Fuhrer democracies is that the more Fuhrer you have, the less democracy you will have over time. And in the end, there is no democracy. You just have this one powerful leader calling shots. And incredibly, to me, this what happened in Hungary really excited populists all around the world. And they said, look, this is our game plan. This is a model for us. Even Vice President J.D. Vance has called, you know, Hungary, says Hungary's got important lessons for American populists and conservatives. So this, what happened in Hungary over a period of a decade is now happening in the United States in a very condensed period, and also happening in a much more chaotic fashion than happened in Hungary itself.
Yeah, I mean, for those that aren't well-versed in the history of the word Führer, I mean, that refers to Hitler. That refers to...
Yeah, Führer is a German, it's a German word, yeah, for leader, for all-powerful leader.
Right. And you've got Orban. I believe that now, I think it's from your article. Now that I didn't realize that Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, introduced the idea of Orban to our Donald Bush even before Donald Bush was president. Is that correct?
That is correct. There's a very strong connection between the state of Israel and the state of Hungary today. Netanyahu is also, and many Israelis would call him also a Führer Democrat, somebody who's a strongman who calls the shots, and who's also whittling away at the checks and balances that exist in democracy, whether that's mocking the media, whether it's destabilizing the judiciary, taking power away from it, ignoring it, debasing the rule of law. And that's all happened very much in Israel, just as it's happened in Hungary and in other countries. I mean, South Korea has had major problems with its democracies, also due to these populist leaders who regard themselves as above the law.
Well, Andrew, you're breaking up a little bit. I don't think there's probably anything you can do about it. You're at the highest point that you can be, right? You're breaking up a little bit.
All right. Hopefully that we'll get our signal back. This is one of the problems of living a rural life in Canada.
I admire that, and just want to have a good connection. I mean, there's a certain irony here. I think Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, just paid a 4-day state visit to Hungary, and now I believe yesterday, maybe still today, he's in Washington. I mean, there's a very serious connection, and you see this fuselage of action from the Trump administration, listing all the items that I mentioned in my intro. But there's an underlying theme, and it refers to this term that you use, that I think you coined from, or you gleaned from, a Hungarian sociologist, of pure democracy. And we should be reminded that Hitler didn't come to power with a coup. He came through a democratic process and then acquired power. And I think it's very important to understand that model and to view it in understanding what's going on in the United States right now.
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, when Hitler did come to power, he was democratically elected, and then and yet Hitler was somebody who had absolutely no respect for democracy. He saw democracy as a weak form of government, and he immediately set about changing the nature of German democracy. And he followed a very familiar playbook in the sense that you start with the judiciary, you change the laws, you centralize power, you kind of control the message. In Hitler's case, that meant shutting down newspapers. His party had its own newspaper. So you want to make sure that you end up with a media that's in line with the regime. And you can even see that in the United States. Even the way that the press corps now operates in Washington, D.C. is totally different. A whole bunch of media outlets that are highly partisan, that are very right-wing, that in many cases would be, you would call them revolutionary outlets, are welcomed now in the White House. An organization like Associated Press is banned from the White House, and it is banned simply because it refused to follow a dictate from Donald Trump. And that dictate was, I think the Gulf of Mexico should now be called the Gulf of America. And the Associated Press said, well, that's ridiculous. We're in, that's a very silly notion, and we're not going along with that. And then Trump said, okay, if you don't go along with what I'm saying and what I'm believing and how I'm reshaping and renaming the world, then you won't be part of any press conferences. So just shut them out. So we're seeing the same forces at work here. And this is exactly what happened in Hungary. With the media. I mean, the media now has been very eclipsed, very debased. Funding for and the government used to fund had it, its own state media, and they replaced all the people there. They brought in new people, and what other independent media there is largely owned by oligarchs, who are great friends with Viktor Orban.
Right. I mean, it's pretty frightening. I mean, I just think it's important. There's this, as we've been talking about, there's this fuselage of initiatives from the Trump administration, and it's important to understand this is not random. This is part of a playbook, that Trump is following from Orban, and arguably going way back to Hitler, which, Orban is not unfamiliar with. I mean, it's very frightening. I'd love to hear from from our listeners, 202-588-0893. Whatever your thoughts are in terms of your immediate experience, in terms of your thoughts on the overarching playbook that Trump is apparently undertaking, we would really like to hear from you. This is Community Watch and Comment. We want your comments. Please chime in, 202-588-0893. So we've got our Elon Musk, a guy that on the day of the inauguration does the Nazi Sieg Heil salute at a rally after the inauguration. I mean, this is a South African coming out of a family, if I understand correctly, with long apartheid racist views, giving the Sieg Heil on January 20th. He is clearly Donald Trump's number two man. Let's talk about Hitler's number two man that you noted in your article, which I can't recommend enough. Maybe you can give out the where people can see it. I don't have it at my fingertips, but wonderful independent press in Canada that expat friend now in Victoria sent to me. That's how I found you. But let's talk about Hermann Göring, who was, I always think of him as the fat man of Hitler, who was put on trial at the Nuremberg trials after the war. And I hadn't realized what the night before he was supposed to be hung, having been convicted at the Nuremberg trials, he committed suicide. You know, of course, one has to wonder how he was able to pull that off with cyanide. But maybe you've got an incredible quote. I have it here if you don't have it handy, from Hermann Göring in his discussion of what he enacted. I believe this was an interview that was undertaken after he was interned after the war.
Well, I mean, when Hitler came to power in 1933, Hermann Göring became his number two man. And as a number two man, one of his first jobs was to make sure that the police department, particularly in Prussia, was in line with the government's goals and objectives. And this meant then you needed to root out people that were not sympathetic to Hitler, and you needed to replace them with loyalists. And this Göring did with great vigor and great spirit. And he said at the time, "My measures will not be enfeebled by legalistic hesitations. My measures will not be enfeebled by bureaucracy." And there was just sort of a total shamelessness in terms of how he exercised power and how he even talked about it. And what struck me about his behavior is how very similar it is to the behaviors of many people in the Trump administration. Just like Hitler in the 1930s, they believe they are part of a revolution. They consider themselves to be revolutionaries. And like these revolutionaries in the 1930s, that there's a certain shamelessness about them. And this seems to be a characteristic of societies that that go from being democracies and find themselves on this kind of one-way street to authoritarianism or totalitarianism or fascism, whatever word you want to use. And it's Göring's shamelessness that strikes me, because I can see the shamelessness in the comments made by Musk. You can see it in the shamelessness of of Donald Trump. You can see it in the shamelessness of J.D. Vance and the comments they make about the world, about other people, and about those that don't agree with them. I think another important thing to remember here is you know, I don't think Donald Trump is another Hitler, but I do think that Donald Trump is very much an authoritarian. And you can trace Donald Trump's roots and even Elon Musk's roots back to movements in the 1930s, such as the American First Movement, which was a highly racist movement that wanted to put America first, that didn't want America to be involved in fighting fascists in Europe, that wanted to expand America's sphere of influence into Canada, Greenland, and all the way down to the Panama Canal. And at the same time, there was another strange movement in the United States, also called called Technology First. And Technology First shared many of the same ideas as America First. Technology Inc. Shared many of the same ideas of America First, with the exception that it felt that really engineers and technicians should be running the whole show, just as Elon Musk and his tribe from Silicon Valley is now redesigning the American government with Doge. And Technology Inc. had this bizarre idea to change America's whole focus away from the rest of the world, concentrate solely on North America, take over Canada, take over Greenland. And what's interesting about this is, to me, at least as a journalist, is that Elon Musk's grandfather was a prominent member of this movement in Canada.
Yeah. He went from Canada to South Africa.
To South Africa. And right. So Elon Musk was, you know, he was raised in a family that didn't really have much respect for democratic virtues. You know, if you grew up in apartheid South Africa, you know, it's unlikely you're going to come out of there with a strong appreciation for how democracy works. It's not going to happen.
Right, right. And we should note, in terms of Donald Trump's embrace of strongmen, I mean, he clearly has an infatuation with Vladimir Putin of Russia, but I believe there are four countries that are exempt from tariff restrictions that Trump has imposed. And those four countries are Russia, North Korea, Cuba, and Belarus. And, you know, what can we say about all four of those countries? You know, they're led by they are not democracies, needless to say. It's a frightening scenario. But going back to Göring, Hitler's number two man, the quote is, the full quote that you have in your very important article is, "My measures will not be enfeebled by any bureaucracy. Here I have not to exercise justice. Here I have only to destroy and exterminate, nothing else." I mean, that's from early in the 30s when the Nazis are coming into power. I mean, it's extremely concerning. And then they have they pretty much do away with democracy in Germany with the burning of the Reichstag, the German legislature. I believe that was in 33, maybe 34, one can only think of the storming of our Congress in 2021 by Trump's followers. I mean, we're looking at a very serious scenario, and it's not just about the day-to-day news about the crippling of your bureaucracy here in the United States, and on and on and on. This is a long-term plan with the undertones of Christian nationalism, which we haven't touched on. We've talked about it previously in the show. It's a very scary scenario.
Well, I think it's really important for both Canadians and Americans to recognize the reality of what is going on. All right, and I think this is difficult for many people to accept the fact that we, you know, that history goes in cycles. You have periods of you know, great gain, happiness, consensus, wealth production, and then you have periods where everything all falls apart, and where you have discord, and you have chaos, and you have discontent, and you have anger. And we have entered one of these historical cycles, and that's what Trump is part of. And I think it's important to remember, you know, what's kind of driving all of this. And there's probably, you know, three critical things. The first is that societies experience enormous political discord when their wealth pump flows only in one direction. In other words, when the rich become richer at the expense of working people and of the middle class, then you introduce a lot of angst and political discord. And the second thing is that as a result of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, you see a lot of things changing socially. So in the United States, you have the amazing and phenomenal increases in death by suicide, particularly among people in their 30s and 40s, death by drug overdose, death by alcoholism. You have loss of faith in institutions. You have this enormous concentration of wealth, where 10% of the population now accounts for 50% of all spending in the economy. I mean, that's almost a medieval kind of situation. So you have this enormous economic inequality driving all of this ferment. You have people losing things, and their life expectancy is going down. Their incomes or wages are going down. There's just this enormous sense of loss and sense of unfairness about the whole system. And then you have, at the same time, you have all of these counter elites rising in the system, all angling for power, and who want to marshal and wrangle this rage and discontent into a direction that's profitable for them. And that's where you end up with the Donald Trump revolution.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the turn to the Fuhrer democracy, and then that's coupled, and I think you've been talking about it, the Fuhrer democracy coupled with the mafia state. And this is an analysis termed coined by Hungarian sociologists. And I think you've been talking about it, but if we could just clarify this, the idea of the Fuhrer democracy, the Hitler democracy coupled with the mafia state. I mean, you know, some have, you know, offhandedly referred to Trump as the godfather, but it's not far off. I mean, some have said, for example, that this whole tariff gambit of his is an opportunity, as the senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, has said, is an opportunity to have, you know, cowering countries come to Trump hat in hand and ask for, you know, some kind of a deal on on the draconian tariffs that's been implemented against them. If you could talk about this idea of the Fuhrer democracy coupled with the mafia state.
All right, well, let's talk. The Fuhrer democracy is very much where you have one all-powerful or one leader who wants to be all-powerful, comes to power democratically, and then proceeds to concentrate power systematically and in a very measured way. And that's happened in Hungary. I mean, that happened in Russia under Putin. It's happened in Israel under Netanyahu. So, you know, the more Fuhrer you have, the less democracy you have. And then what can also happen in this situation then, as one person grabs more and more power, then, of course, you have abuse of that power. And in Hungary, what you have essentially is a mafia state. So you have a country that is run by one man and his family, essentially, and that then uses the resources of the government to enrich his family. And that's a mafia state. You could also call it a godfather state if you want to. I think Americans would, you know, that's what it is. And if you want to make money in a mafia state, you have to respect the godfather, right? You have to go to the godfather and say, yes, godfather, I'm offering you my respect. I'm going to follow your orders. And then we will loot, essentially, the nation state, so that particular families, particular people, particular oligarchs get all of the wealth. And that's very, that's how Hungary operates in Europe. There's no other country in Europe that operates that way. And that's actually how Russia operates. And it would be more than frightening if this is the kind of the future for the United States, where you have particular individuals in government directly benefiting from their business with government, because the godfather, the Fuhrer, likes them, approves of them, feels they have respected him enough and will reward their respect with the ability to. And this is, of course, the big concern about Elon Musk. When you take the world's wealthiest man and you put him in charge of downsizing the bureaucracy of the federal government, and this is a guy who's done $34 billion worth of contracts with the federal government. He's got $11 billion worth of contracts currently on the books, who's got three very enormously powerful companies that are all doing business with the United States government, that many parts of the American government are actually investigating these companies for wrongdoing, for breaking the law, for not following the law, that you would give all of this power to one man to to reshape your government takes you very close into the mafia state territory.
Yep. We'd love to hear from folks if you want to chime in on this extraordinarily important topic about the future of our democracy or the lack thereof. 202-588-0893. This is Community Watch and Comment. We need your comments. Don't want to be in a cloister shell here. We want to hear from you all. So please do chime in if you care to do so. This is like an incredibly important topic. So let's talk about specifically what Viktor Orban had done in Hungary. I mean, in 2010, Hungary was considered a pretty vibrant democracy. It is no longer considered so. He's neutered the courts. He's changed election laws. He's taken over the majority of the media. I mean, we can say the same is happening in the United States. I mean, when you have, you know, a weakened media dealing with a weakened judiciary, which is happening right before our eyes, I mean, neither are going to come out well in this analysis. If you could talk about that.
Well, Viktor Orban has been very methodical and systematic, and he has weakened the institutions we associate with protecting democracy, but the institutions that provide a checks and balance to a strong man. I mean, he dismantled them all, and he started with the judiciary, and he, in fact, I mean, he sacked, I think, 300 judges, and they were all replaced with people sympathetic to Viktor Orban and his party. He changed how different media organizations in Hungary were funded, so that he ended up only supporting those organizations that supported him. He defunded a lot of NGOs, and then he also would, and I think this is really important, the other thing he did is that he kind of put the country on a war footing, in the sense that he behaved as though elections were taking place all the time. And so Viktor Orban was always in a complete attack mode, and he would find different subjects to attack to unite his base, to unite the country, and to give Hungary a sense of purpose. So, that, I mean, the first person that he attacked was George Soros, who was a billionaire, who has spent lots of money funding democratic movements throughout Eastern Europe. And he attacked him as an interloper and as an enemy of the Hungarian people. And then he went from George Soros to immigrants and Muslims. And so Viktor Orban always has, someone on attack. And now it would be Eastern Europe. So that's also a very important mechanism. If you want to debase and weaken your democracy, and you want to further this movement towards authoritarian rule, it's really important that the all-powerful leader is constantly attacking an enemy, whether this enemy is real or not.
You know, and we're running out of time. I mean, Hitler, you know, went after the Jews, and our dear fearless leader Trump is going after immigrants. You know, the Haitians are eating our pets, et cetera, et cetera. But we have a couple of callers in the little time that we have left. I'm so glad you're chiming in. Please make your question or your comment short. We don't have much time, but so appreciate you calling. Caller, your question or your comment, your name and where you're calling from, if you care to, and your comment.
Is this me?
Yeah, you're on. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for your wonderful show. I agree with everything that you're talking about, and I'm concerned as you are. If you wouldn't mind, please making sure to make it very clear to the listeners who your guest is and what, if any, information or publications or whatever, information like that. And the only other question I have is the guest aware that he's pronouncing Elon as Elon, which is, I believe, incorrect, according not only to Elon, but everybody else who I've ever heard pronounce his name. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Thanks for calling in, Andrew. It's important people know where to follow you and where they can hear and read your publications.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say that thank you for the correction on Elon. I'm a Canadian journalist. I'm based in Alberta. I write for a publication called the TYEE .ca. You can find all of our stuff there. The TYEE writes primarily about Western Canada and politics in British Columbia, but we also look at the rest of the world as well. I'm a Canadian journalist, but I was raised and educated in the United States. So I have a great and abiding interest in what is happening to its politics.
Wonderful. And I think we have another caller. So I appreciate you chiming in, your name, where you're calling from, if you care to, and your question or comment.
Yes, my question is Elon, everyone is well aware of what he is doing, but no one has given any kind of information or suggestions or comments as to how he can no longer be a part of this administration. He was not voted in. So what can Americans do in order to, like, have him removed?
Any thoughts on that, Andrew?
Well, that's a good question, and it really comes back to congressional representation. And I think Americans have to call their congressmen and their senators and say, look, something that is going on in the American government that is really, truly not legal, that a billionaire can be brought in to essentially redesign how the government works. And so I think Americans must put pressure on their representatives at the most basic level to get them to act.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, we in D.C. don't have any voting representation, but the rest of the country, I think, would say, you know, it appears that Congress is at the moment not able to move, you know, constructively against the increasing power of the presidency. But I guess one can only hope, you know, and as you know, one is wont to say, you know, Trump is, you know, arguably, you know, slowly hanging himself with his tariff gambit and various other ventures. But in the meantime, Congress appears to be cowed, and with Republicans in majority in the Senate and the House is not operating in the basic check and balance that the Founding Fathers created. They were very, very concerned about someone like Trump taking over. I think I just recently learned that the Founding Fathers were very concentrated on the legacy, the history of Caesar. There was a big biography came out in 1770, and the Founding Fathers were very concerned about, you know, an increasing power in a presidency that they were, you know, rebelling against and fighting against England and King George, the Mad King, as they say. In closing, we are out of time, but any closing thoughts real quickly, Andrew, if you would.
Well, I think this is a time for both Canadians and Americans to remember that if we don't take an interest in politics, then really bad politics will take an interest in us. And, you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. And when it becomes a spectator sport, it loses its vitality.
Yep. Yep. So appreciate you joining us today. I've been speaking with Andrew Nikiforuk, a Canadian journalist. We want to get you back for your perspective, and particularly, you know, once we invade Canada, we want to be hearing from you. That's for sure. Thank you so much for all you're doing and for joining us today.
Thank you very much, David.
And we are now joined by our, I believe we have her on, our esteemed program director. Are you with me?
Hi, David. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning. It's great to have you. So what's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you and applaud you for a wonderful show. So important to keep lifting this very troubling development up and keep resisting. And that is exactly what WPFW does. And we have been doing it for 48 years. And we're celebrating 48 years on April 25th at the Martin's Crosswinds. It's our anniversary celebration. Many might already know that our anniversary was technically the end of February, but we wanted to make sure we had time to do it right. So we are coming together as the WPFW family and inviting others to celebrate with us. We will have dinner. There will be drinks and then dinner, and we have performances by Navasha Deya, who is not only a wonderful artist that embodies the Indigenous feminine spirit and inspires women throughout the world with her music. Many of our listeners may know her or may have been introduced to her through the group Fertile Ground. So she will be our featured performer. But we have two esteemed poets who are right in WPFW's midst. That would be Zane El Amin, who hosts Shea Wainana. He's also an award-winning poet, and he has a latest book entitled Is This How You Eat a Watermelon? A book of poetry. And then Esther Iverum, who is also an esteemed poet, excuse me, and host of On the Ground. She will be reading from her book, Olokun of the Galaxy. And then we have dancing provided with music provided by DJ James Funk. So it'll be a full evening of comrades coming together to celebrate WPFW, to remember that the people have the power, to applaud WPFW from its inception, really understanding that we stand in solidarity with marginalized and oppressed peoples around the world, and we have not wavered from that commitment. Details are at WPFWFM.org.
I mean, it's going to be quite an evening. And as Katia did, our program director is saying, you can get all the information, WPFWFM.org, or just Google WPFWFM, or WPFWFM will get you to all the information you need for this extraordinary evening. It's going to be quite a fest. You're going to have wonderful dining, wonderful music, wonderful poetry. I mean, who could ask for anything more?
Absolutely. You know, so again, it's your opportunity. There's so much trouble in the world, to quote Bob Marley, but there's also beauty in resistance. There's beauty in struggle, and WPFW has always found that place. And again, our WPFW, the entire listening family, is invited. We hope that many will join us. And David, of course, again, I want to thank you for your wonderful program. That is part of that resistance, that spirit of ensuring that the voices that are forcibly silenced are heard. And again, information at WPFWFM.org. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much for being with us, Katia. And please attend our gathering. I think, you know, more than ever, WPFW is important in the mix of your information intake at this incredibly crucial time in our American democracy. And that's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to Mike Nocella for pulling us through with his engineering expertise. Coming up, we've got the news headlines, followed by Don't Forget the Blues with the extraordinary Lady Muir. Love to hear from you, draben902, D-R-A-B-I-N 902 at gmail.com. Please stay safe. Thanks for listening and have a good week. I'm Dave Raben. Take care.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly 5 decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For close to 50 years, WPFW has amplified the voices, told the stories, and shared the history and culture of Black people throughout the diaspora. In short, we are Black history. Black is WPFW. Texting WPFWFM to 801-801 will help to protect this medium in the Black radical tradition so that we can continue to chronicle Black hope, sorrow, and resistance.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. In detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country. In the words of Andrew,